Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Federal Habeas Relief and State Timeliness Requirements Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 23, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Walker v. Martin. The case involves a California rule that bars a state inmate from prevailing on his or her petition for habeas corpus relief in state court if the inmate substantially delayed in filing the petition. The question before the Supreme Court was whether an inmate's failure to satisfy this state timeliness rule constituted grounds for denying the inmate's otherwise timely petition for similar habeas relief in federal court. In a unanimous opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held that California's timeliness rule qualifies as an independent state ground that is adequate to bar habeas relief in federal court. To discuss the case, we have Kent S. Scheidegger, who is the legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Scheidegger.
The United States Supreme Court has long recognized that it has no jurisdiction to review a case from a state court if that court's decision rests on an independent state ground. In some cases, the state ground may be procedural. That is, the party asserting a federal right may have lost that claim through failure to present it in accordance with state rules of procedure. A similar limitation applies when the lower federal courts review state criminal judgments on habeas corpus. However, there is an exception when the state rule of procedure is deemed inadequate. The Supreme Court jurisprudence on what constitutes an inadequate state ground has been a haphazard patchwork over the years, criticized by many commentators. The Hart and Wexler casebook, for example, puts these cases under the heading of varying rubrics. On direct review of state judgments, the Supreme Court was active in this area in the 1960s, mostly in civil rights cases where Southern courts were intentionally trying to evade Supreme Court precedent. In recent years, though, the issue has rarely come up on direct review. The High Court took up the question in 2008 in Philip Morris v. Williams, but then dropped the case without explanation. On habeas corpus, some federal courts of appeals have regularly declared state procedural default rules inadequate. These declarations enable the federal courts to consider on habeas corpus objections that the defendant had failed to raise in their first appeal in the state courts. The formulation most commonly applied in these decisions is that a state procedural default rule must be firmly established and regularly followed in order to be adequate for the purpose of foreclosing federal review of the defaulted claim. Federal courts of appeals have varied on how firm and how regular the state needed to be in order to qualify. The Fifth Circuit noted that an occasional act of grace, considering an otherwise defaulted claim on the merits, should not disqualify a state procedural rule. The Seventh Circuit similarly noted the perversity of rewarding states for having rigid rules and punishing them for having flexible and discretionary rules. However, the Ninth Circuit took a different view and effectively declared all of California's rules regarding default on appeal and habeas corpus to be inadequate. Last term, in Beard v. Kindler, the Supreme Court addressed a particularly severe application of the adequate state grounds doctrine. In that case, the Third Circuit declared a Pennsylvania rule inadequate because the court had discretion to waive it. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and Amicus Curiae Criminal Justice Legal Foundation argued that the court should abandon the firmly established and regularly followed rubric and instead adopt a rule along the lines proposed in the Wright and Miller treatise, that a state procedural rule is adequate if it provides the defendant with fair notice of the correct procedure for raising his objection. In Kindler, the court decided that a rule could not be declared inadequate simply for being discretionary, but it chose not to address the broader issue. Charles Martin was convicted of murder in California in 1995 and sentenced to life in prison. Various claims against his conviction were reviewed on direct appeal and a first state habeas petition, and these claims were denied. He then filed a habeas petition in federal district court. As often happens, his federal habeas attorney wished to make claims that had never been made to the state courts. The governing federal statute requires that state remedies be exhausted before a claim can be considered on federal habeas corpus. Martin returned to the California Supreme Court with a second state habeas petition, 5 years after the affirmance of his conviction on direct appeal, and 3 years after denial of his first state habeas petition. The California Supreme Court denied this new petition summarily under the state rule against untimely petitions. That rule requires filing without substantial delay. The Ninth Circuit, applying circuit precedent, held that the state rule was inadequate and directed the district court to consider the claims on the merits. The state of California sought review in the United States Supreme Court, making an argument similar to that made by Pennsylvania in the Kindler case. The court should drop its rubric of firmly established and regularly followed, and instead adopt fair notice as the standard. In a short, unanimous opinion by Justice Ginsburg, the Supreme Court retained the label firmly established and regularly followed, but in the process it redefined the meaning of that phrase as something completely different from what the Ninth Circuit had been following and much closer to what the state had proposed. First, reaffirming Kindler, the court held that the California rule is not inadequate simply because it is discretionary. As a necessary consequence, the court also held that the rule is not inadequate because it applied a general standard of reasonable time rather than a crisply defined cutoff. Second, the court held that regularly followed does not mean mechanical, invariable application. When a habeas petition is both patently meritless and arguably untimely, as many are, denying such petitions on the merits rather than on timeliness, where that is the easier decision, does not impair the adequacy of the state rule. Further, a habeas petitioner cannot brand a state rule as inadequate merely by pointing to differing results in similar but borderline cases. This conclusion also follows from Kindler's approval of discretionary rules. Different judges applying the same discretionary rule will necessarily come to different conclusions in close cases. So, what remains of the inadequate state grounds doctrine? First, the court says a state procedural ground is inadequate if it fails to provide fair notice, quoting the Wright and Miller treatise, exactly what the state proposed. Second, a state ground is inadequate if it is used in a way that discriminates against claims of federal rights, citing two very old cases. That was a major problem decades ago, but it can rarely be credibly claimed today. Finally, Justice Ginsburg mentions in a footnote her 2002 opinion in Lee v. Kemna, which she refers to as the state court's persnickety application of a procedural rule despite the defendant's substantial compliance. So, along with the fair notice and non-discrimination requirements, we now have the persnickety application doctrine. This decision is a major change in states such as California, where the federal courts had regularly allowed habeas petitioners to raise new claims in federal habeas that they never mentioned on appeal or the first state habeas petition. In capital cases, particularly, this has been a major source of delay. The law of habeas corpus provides exceptions, allowing defaulted claims on a showing of good cause or actual innocence, but in the absence of such unusual circumstances, the processing of these cases should now be significantly expedited.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.